This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Rocket Billionaires, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and the New Space Race. Written by Tim Fernholz. Performed by Aaron Moon.
Introduction. The Rocket crowd has been going to the same swamp in Florida for years. A triangular headland along the Atlantic coast, battered by hurricanes, Cape Canaveral might have become just another dubious land development scheme, a way to get out-of-state GIs to buy vacation homes in a swamp now that World War II was over. But serious men with slide rules got to it first. They examined maps of the United States for real estate where they could hurl large machines full of explosives out over the ocean, in case they came back down again at distressing speed, and near enough to the equator that the Earth's spin would help the hurling. They liked the Cape just fine. That was more than half a century ago. The Florida wetlands were filled in with concrete foundations for the American effort to leave Earth and to travel the empty space around the planet and its nearby moon. First Mercury, then Gemini, and finally, Apollo. As space became less the realm of the gods and more amenable to man, bureaucracy replaced divinity. Skylab and then Space Shuttle. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, had in 1958 begun life as an ad hoc assembly that included former Nazis, corn-fed American engineers, and brave test pilots racing the Soviets. It became a Baroque institution focused primarily on building and maintaining the most expensive contraption constructed in human history, the International Space Station, ISS, a research outpost in orbit. The U.S. victory in the first international space race inspired awe. The sheer quantities of money and brain power and science, all bending physics to the purpose of putting fragile mankind in a place where he did not belong. After the Apollo program, the ambitious space program gave way to a kind of complacency. There was a nagging sense that what the United States had done in going to the moon wasn't about what those pioneers had achieved, but what it had meant to those watching. NASA amounted to a sophisticated Cold War propaganda operation. Once it had demonstrated the ability to go to the moon, there was no obvious reason to go back. Presidents paid lip service to space exploration, but most who persisted in casting their eye toward the stars were seen as nostalgists. Enter Elon Musk, the founder and CEO of Space Exploration Technologies Corporation. He also enjoys the title Chief Designer and is clearly not a nostalgist, especially by the standards of rocket nerds. The intense South African-born entrepreneur started SpaceX, as it is called, so he could retire on Mars. On this day, his company was giving him a 44th birthday present. It would launch a rocket into orbit and, for the first time in history, return it safely to Earth. Space Launch Complex 40, SLC 40, at Cape Canaveral, is heavy with history. Too much of it in the form of accumulated rules, habits, and conventional wisdom, in Musk's opinion. Musk's engineers had refurbished the old Air Force launch pad to operate efficiently, scavenging gear to move quickly and cheaply. They were now building a new private spaceport in Texas. But the realities of the space business demanded that SpaceX fly its rockets from the Cape, far from where they were built and tested, on a launch pad leased from the government. The plain truth was that the government didn't even have its own rockets anymore. That was SpaceX's business now. On June 28, 2015, with launch in half an hour, a Falcon 9 rocket built by SpaceX stood on that pad. It was 230 feet tall and 13 feet in diameter. The area was clear of people so that Musk's creation could be fed thousands of pounds of liquid oxygen and high-test kerosene. The super-chilled fluid flowing through the machine caused the sticky Florida air to condense. Great bursts of steam made the rocket appear to breathe smoke, befitting the name of the spacecraft on top, the Dragon. Like a can of soda, most of a rocket's launch mass is fluid, but comparing an aluminum rocket to a can of Coca-Cola does the rocket a disservice. Its walls are far, far thinner, relatively speaking, than those on a beverage container. And in order to fit even more propellant into the rocket, it would be chilled to as low as minus 340 degrees Fahrenheit. In the control room at SpaceX headquarters, young controllers monitored pressure gauges, telemetry feeds, and cameras affixed all over the vehicle, even inside propellant tanks. Engineers participated in the company's live online stream of the launch, explaining the basics of the flight to the hundreds of thousands of fans and curiosity seekers tuning in to watch. Back in Florida, NASA officials, Air Force officers, and SpaceX's operations team all watched the countdown from behind computer consoles. Were the government officials envious of the company's capabilities? Musk's were the first privately owned spacecraft to fly a NASA mission to the International Space Station. To be sure, SpaceX had needed the space agency's funding and advice. But Musk insisted the rocket be designed according to his own principles, and each part of the tall white vehicle belonged to his company's shareholders. This was not a mere technicality. It was a revolutionary approach to spaceflight. And it was necessary for Musk's broader ambitions of making humans into a multi-planetary civilization. Musk hadn't spent $100 million of his own money and the past 13 years of his life simply to accomplish today's mission. Carrying 4,000 pounds, a mass you could move with a Dodge Ram truck, a few hundred miles, the distance between New York City and Boston. A trivial job until you realize that you're moving those 2 tons straight up. While the rocket prepared for launch, three astronauts were on board the ISS, 250 miles above the Earth. They live in a series of aluminum tubes bolted together, circling our planet at great speed. Keeping them alive required regular visits from spacecraft carrying food, water, and oxygen, as well as the scientific apparatus and experiments that provided the justification for their improbable presence in space. Since constructing the station, in concert with international partners, chiefly Russia and the European Union, NASA had been forced to retire its only means of reaching it. In 2011, the space shuttle had been shut down for being too costly and dangerous to fly. Now the U.S. space program, founded quite literally to demonstrate superiority over Russia, could not reach its most expensive scientific installation without Russian aid. NASA had attempted to replace the space shuttle with several alternatives. Despite spending billions of dollars, mostly funneled to the shareholders of giant aerospace corporations, it had no new answers. After Barack Obama became president, his administration took an axe to the latest over-budget, delayed scheme to build a new rocket, and space capsule. Let the space agency worry about the rest of the solar system. To keep the ISS operational, Obama's team would build on a George W. Bush-era program that envisioned privatizing transit between Earth and the space station. This was the opportunity that Musk and his nascent space company had desperately needed. Tinkerers at the time, they had blown up more rockets than they had flown. Many considered Musk just another wealthy fool from Silicon Valley with a space bug. A decade before, Microsoft founder Bill Gates had invested millions in plans for an ambitious network of satellites, called a constellation, that people would use to connect to the internet. It ended in bankruptcy. The major space contractors like Boeing, Lockheed Martin, and Northrop Grumman, armies of engineers with decades of practice, scoffed at the idea that youthful companies backed by software engineers might be up to the challenge of space travel. Still, Musk saw a way in, starting at the bottom. He'd build rockets to do the grunt work of space, starting with flying other people's satellites. Then he signed a contract with NASA to ferry gear to the ISS. Water tanks, freeze-dried food, and science experiments. The jobs might have lacked glamour compared with building the largest satellite constellation ever, or lunar exploration. See the glamour now. The gleaming white, gently steaming machine on the launch pad looked like Steve Jobs' idea of a rocket. Since it first flew in 2010, it had changed a global industry. Listed at $62 million, it cost half as much as the orbital rockets marketed by SpaceX's competitors. After just 18 successful flights, six of them for NASA, SpaceX's relentless president and chief operating officer, Gwynne Shotwell, had built a launch manifest worth $10 billion for the vehicle, winning contracts from major satellite operators from around the world. All this despite the fact that its main competitors were national champions, those heavily subsidized technology contractors embedded in the military-industrial complexes of the United States, Europe, and Russia. No longer scoffing, the aerospace establishment began to look at SpaceX in a new light. Rockets that can launch many tons into orbit are usually enormously expensive, on the order of hundreds of millions of dollars, and typically entirely disposable. Each time one flies, complicated machinery built of the strongest and lightest materials available is simply thrown away. Once it has lifted its payload into orbit, the rocket burns up in the atmosphere, plunges into the ocean, or drifts aimlessly away in space. The layman can see an obvious way to save money here. Use the damn thing again. But no company or country had built an efficient, reusable rocket. The space shuttle came closest, but relied on a disposable fuel tank and required months of expensive refurbishment after each flight. The two disasters that marred the program, the loss of Challenger in 1986 and Columbia in 2003, were each linked to how the vessel withstood repeated exposure to the extreme stress of space travel. Aerospace engineers considering reusability for the next generation of American rockets thought the expense wouldn't pay off in the end. Nobody flew enough rockets regularly, and the extra complications involved were just more ways that rockets, temperamental machines on the best days, could turn from vehicles into bombs. Pay for reliability, not efficiency. Musk thought differently. SpaceX's philosophy was to let the science of physics decide what was possible and what was not. There was no technical obstacle to flying the rocket booster, stuffed with expensive mechanics and electronics, back to Earth. The U.S. space program had experimented with reusable rockets in the 1990s, flying one almost 2 miles into the air and bringing it back down to the ground safely. NASA canceled the program after a failed test left it with no money to continue, with the space shuttle still handling most government space transportation. There was little demand for another reusable rocket. Outside the government, the nascent commercial satellite industry put so much money into its enormous satellites that it chose to trust proven rockets built by government-preferred contractors, even if they were costly. Russia boasted the Soyuz and Proton rockets. Europe, its Ariane 5. And the United States had the Atlas and Delta families. Times had changed, in Musk's opinion. It was the 21st century, after all. There was more demand for launches than people knew, and demand could be boosted with the right product. There could be a virtuous cycle. If the cost of space access fell enough to make new businesses possible in orbit, there would be more money to invest in lowering the cost to access space. It was an attitude he had developed as an entrepreneur in the early days of the internet boom. Not many had thought that a new way of paying for goods and services on the internet was necessary in 1999. But Musk and the other members of the so-called PayPal Mafia, many of whom, like the investors Peter Thiel and Luke Nosek, would also back SpaceX, were not deterred. Once they had built their simple tool for exchanging money safely over the emerging consumer web, other entrepreneurs found ways to use it. The ability to exchange money online became the basis for a whole new economy. When the auction site eBay paid $1.5 billion for PayPal in 2002, Musk's share of the proceeds provided him with the fortune to find new markets, including space. The Falcon 9 rocket was SpaceX's first killer app. Like most other orbital rockets, the Falcon 9 is actually two vehicles combined into one. The largest is called the first stage, or booster, and it is packed with 9 engines, plus tanks, containing all the propellant needed to feed them. Stacked on top is another vehicle called the second stage, with just one engine. The spacecraft that is carried into orbit, it could be a satellite, a dozen satellites, or a Dragon capsule, is mounted on top of the second stage. At launch, the first stage does the hard work of hauling its own weight, the second stage and its cargo battling gravity and the atmosphere. This heavy lifting begins to dissipate as the rocket enters space at a boundary known as the Kármán line, universally and somewhat arbitrarily recognized as 100 kilometers, 62 miles, above sea level. At that point, moving at 4 times the speed of sound, the engines shut off and the two stages separate. But that word disguises the drama of the event. Pneumonic pushers force the rocket apart, and the engine in the second stage ignites as the booster plunges back to Earth. At this point, the second stage takes over, carrying the payload up to wherever its destination may be, anywhere from 250 miles to 23,000 miles above the Earth. For most rockets, after stage separation, that big first stage's job is done. At the Cape, it tumbles into the ocean. When China's space program launches its rockets, first stages occasionally drop into villages, and Chinese citizens will pose for photos next to the enormous aluminum cylinders found lying across roads. SpaceX's rockets had other plans. After separation, as the first stage descended, something different would happen. The engines would turn back on. 4 waffle-perforated metal fins mounted on the side would unfold, and the 14-story-tall aluminum pencil wouldn't be falling anymore. It would be flying. Engines pointed at the Earth to slow it. A few hundred feet above the Earth, 4 huge landing legs would unfold, just like in a science fiction film from the 1950s. The Falcon 9 first stage, weighing about 20 tons, would then set down gently on a landing pad, the rockets shutting off as the legs hover just inches above the Earth. At least, that was the idea. By the time of its 7th mission to the ISS, SpaceX had brought down the rocket into empty stretches of ocean to prove that when it returned to sea level, it would be in the right place and under control. Next, the booster progressed to seagoing landing pads. These were enormous barges the company retrofitted to be autonomous. It was too dangerous to have people on board when the rocket arrived. This proved to be an intelligent decision. The first 2 landing attempts resulted in spectacular explosions. Each failure taught the SpaceX team a little more about how the landing systems worked and improved the computer algorithms guiding the rocket. During the previous mission, 2 months before, the rocket had landed, actually landed standing upright, on the floating drone ship. But it was unbalanced, and observers watched the live video feed in dismay as it tipped over with agonizing slowness. The remaining propellant ignited spectacularly. SpaceX's numerous fans loved the show and cheered the company's chutzpah. NASA executives, cringed. This time around, Musk thought they'd get it right. Publicly, he predicted an even chance of success, not that anyone outside the company was convinced. NASA officials had cringed not just because of the last failure, but because of how SpaceX was testing its reusable rockets, rather than flying purely experimental missions to develop the reusability technology. They simply tested them while performing launches for their clients. And why not? Technically, nothing related to the reusability system went into effect until after the client's cargo was safely away, flying on the second stage. But each change to the rocket, made in the spirit of iteration, caused agita among traditional rocket professionals. Any tiny adjustment to the shape of the rocket could affect its aerodynamic profile. Small changes to the complicated hydraulic systems in the engines could have repercussions anywhere. Rocketry rarely goes wrong because of some major error. It goes wrong because of some tiny, unanticipated flaw. Nonetheless, "Test as we fly" became another slogan of SpaceX, another way to differentiate itself from the old companies whose launch it intended to eat. As an innovation strategy, it was brilliant. The company was earning revenue directly from its research and development projects. It's a common tactic for digital companies, which continuously A/B test, the practice of serving different messages to the users on their sites and assessing their efficacy. But could techniques of iteration work as well in a business based not on ephemeral bits, but on machines controlling violent chemical reactions? Now, the countdown was beginning to approach its climax. At 5 minutes before launch, the flight director checked in with the control team monitoring the rocket's engine and guidance systems, the Dragon, the status of the landing pad, the weather, even the flight path of the space station itself. All systems go. The tall stanchion that supported the rocket and raised it to vertical, called the strongback, disconnected and leaned back from the rocket. 1 minute left on the countdown. The ground controllers put the rocket in the hands of its own internal flight computers. Seconds before ignition, water poured from the enormous pipes onto the launch pad. The water would absorb the sound of the engines so their vibration wouldn't tear the rocket apart. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. We have liftoff of the Falcon 9. Great clouds of smoke poured from the rocket as it strained upward, rising from the launch pad. A jet of flame nearly as long as the rocket itself poured from its 9 rocket engines as it rose, with almost painful slowness. Stage 1 propulsion is nominal. After 30 seconds, the rocket was miles above the ground, gaining speed, briefly disappearing into the clouds before emerging above them. After a minute, the rocket was going faster than the speed of sound. Another 30 seconds later, it hit max Q, the time of maximum force exerted on the rocket, when the power of the engines and the intersection of gravity and atmospheric drag pulls and twists at the vehicle's metal structure. The rocket was 14 miles up, moving at 1,542 miles an hour and still accelerating. 10 seconds later, the rocket flew to almost 1,900 miles per hour, 19 miles above the Earth. As the atmosphere thinned, the shape of the rocket's exhaust wake changed from a dagger of flame into a kind of 9-petaled flower of wispy clouds. Seconds later, there was nothing but smoke. It poured from the top of the rocket, engulfing it in a haze. The Falcon 9 disappeared. And when the smoke cleared, there was nothing to see but scattered, plummeting debris. The rocket had flown for 2 minutes and 18 seconds before exploding. 300,000 people watching the company's live video stream online were left staring at the pure baby blue Florida sky. There weren't even good pictures of the disaster. It was as if the rocket had just vanished. Musk's birthday had taken a turn for the worse. He took in the news, and then He started tweeting. Chapter 1. Adventure Capitalism. Many people have said that the fastest way to make a small fortune in the aerospace industry is to start with a large one. Elon Musk. Musk was hardly the only billionaire entrepreneur seeking to make a big splash in the space industry. On the contrary, it seemed as if anyone who'd made it big in consumer tech was finding a way to put a little money and time into a far-fetched space venture. Most of these enthusiasts, whatever their previous successes in commerce, failed the harsh tests of the rocket business. The ragtag band of space geeks who cheered, critiqued, and often worked for these bets on the high frontier watched wealthy visionaries of all stripes, from bankers to former astronauts, try to build businesses in space and fail. Many of the billionaires hailed from Silicon Valley and the tech sector. Most had succeeded in creating profitable businesses while being told that their plans were silly, financially dubious, or plain impossible. They had a knack for convincing other people to put their money and time behind risky ideas that promised a big payoff. And they understood trends in technology, particularly in telecommunications and the internet, that would drive private capital into the rocket business. One narrative for understanding the rise of internet companies in the United States at the turn of the century is that government network technology was spun out into the private sector. Fortunes had been built on top of the computer networking revolution, which was spurred by the Defense Department's needs. Couldn't a similarly lucrative ecosystem be derived from the billions of dollars NASA had spent developing space technology? Initially, the answer was a very hard no. As the 1990s internet boom blossomed, its luminaries quickly saw that dial-up internet over phone lines wasn't going to move enough data around for all the audio and video applications they already foresaw as the future. They also wanted to cut the cord and find a wireless solution. While fiber optic cables were beginning to carry the load of internet traffic, they were controlled by telecoms. The business was heavily regulated, and it required lots of workforce and maintenance. Why not leave those earthly problems behind and put your network in space? At the time, commercial satellites existed, but expense limited their use to entertainment companies broadcasting television shows and live sporting events to a mass market. Putting a satellite communications network into orbit was a much more complex technological challenge, one that would need huge amounts of capital up front. The kinds of institutions with billions of dollars to invest in a business, however, tended to the conservative side. But as the stock market rose behind Microsoft, Netscape, PayPal, and eBay, it created a class of super high net worth individuals who thought they understood the technology and fully embraced risk. Among the first to take a swing was Bill Gates, who, with his childhood friend Paul Allen, co-founded a little company called Microsoft in 1975. By the 90s, it dominated the digital economy to the point of monopoly. Led by telecom entrepreneur Craig McCaw and backed by Saudi Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal, Gates financed a company called Teledesic. The new company would launch and operate a huge network of hundreds of telecommunications satellites. This constellation of satellites would provide voice and data services to customers around the world, bestriding mere terrestrial phone lines like an orbital colossus. But this glorious vision was to end in bankruptcy even before a single satellite was launched. Veterans of the project ascribed Teledesic's failure to a number of challenges. It was an idea that had arrived too soon, and the technology to make the satellites and launches cheap enough to be feasible just didn't exist yet. It was also a crowded market. Besides Teledesic, firms like Iridium and Global Star were also planning to fly large communications constellations, worrying investors who saw the already risky plays as being locked into a suicide pact. All three companies would go bankrupt, Iridium and Global Star would reemerge several years later as key players in the satellite industry. The entire satellite brain trust, and the world at large, were taken by surprise by mobile phones. As telecoms swept around the world to expand high-capacity cellular networks, ground-based antennae linked to fiber-optic cables, they gobbled up a huge amount of the prospective market for satellite communications. And despite the hopes of Teledesic's financiers, the terrestrial networks did so at a much lower cost than the satellite companies could match. This revolution would prove fruitful to the space sector in just a few years, but at this moment, it was fatal. The final straw, if one was needed to break the camel's back, was the stock market crash of 2000, which marked the end of the tech boom. As the tide receded for the dot-coms, major investors sold out their riskiest plays, and that meant no more easy money for people using explosives to launch 5-ton orbital computers. If any of these satellite firms had hoped to raise new money, the markets made it clear that it wasn't the time. The year 2000 was an appropriately futuristic time for a different tech entrepreneur to lay the groundwork for a bet on space. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos. The king of internet retail had taken his fledgling online bookstore public in 1996. In 1999, he had been Time magazine's Person of the Year. Amazon survived the downturn and thrived, thanks to Bezos's demanding style and focus on measurable results. He could take some time to pursue a personal project. As the world entered a new millennium, Bezos started a new LLC called Blue Origin. The company's name referenced humanity's starting point on Earth, but implied a future somewhere else. It would be the nest for Bezos's fledgling space dreams. At the time, few outside of Bezos's inner circle knew about the company, and most would not for years. It lay dormant, acting more like a space think tank than a design and engineering company. It was a secretive place. There were rumors about space tourism and space elevators. In 2005, Bezos walked into a small office in the back of a radio shack in Van Horn, Texas, to see the editor of the Van Horn Advocate. Bezos had just purchased 165,000 acres of land in the tiny West Texas town, population 3,000, about 2 hours southeast of El Paso. He intended to build a private rocket test site where Blue could safely put new space technology through its paces. He also wanted to build a ranch for his family, a remote refuge like the one his grandfather had owned, which Bezos had visited as a child. He wanted local residents, some skeptical of outsiders with big ideas, to hear the plans directly from him. "He told me their first spacecraft is going to carry 3 people up to the edge of space and back," the editor Larry Simpson told the Associated Press. But ultimately, his thing is space colonization. Bezos told Simpson that he was building a space port. News traveled around the country quickly. Bezos declined to speak to the AP about the project, and a spokesman simply said that the company wouldn't go anywhere soon. That, at least, was true. Amazon was already big, but not yet the Goliath it is today. This was before iPhones led the smartphone revolution, before the Kindle, before Amazon Prime, and before Amazon Web Services and Alexa. At this stage in its lifespan, the retailer hadn't even made an annual profit, despite spending the past 4 years as a publicly traded company. Investors loved the stock because of its incredible growth rates, the way it scarfed up market share, even entire markets, with ravenous energy. The idea of Bezos devoting time and energy to another company, especially one with such a nebulous future, wasn't likely to play well with investors who already tolerated quite a bit of eccentricity. So after the announcement of the spaceport and the opening of a design facility in Seattle, the company's first big capital investments, Blue Origin resumed radio silence. Bezos' decision to reveal his company with a Texas surprise may have been spurred by another ultra-wealthy space geek, one with a much greater penchant for the limelight. Admittedly, that's a long list, but here we refer to the English entrepreneur Richard Branson. He of the blonde going white goatee, a toothy grin perpetually stretched across his face, and above all, the eye to seize an opportunity. Branson and his Virgin Group were as much a story of marketing prowess as anything else. After starting a music magazine as a teenager, he had built his fortune selling music during the 70s and 80s under the brand name Virgin, undercutting existing distributors and creating a retail empire. Branson expanded his conglomerate to include a record label, television stations, and eventually an airline and a mobile telecom provider. Branson wasn't an obvious innovator in product. What set all his businesses apart was flair, youth culture branding, and Branson's own larger-than-life personality. And in 2004, he saw opportunity in flying humans to the stars above. At the time, there existed only one privately funded, flight-proven vehicle that could take humans up to space. It was called Spaceship One, and in 2004 it won the Ansari X Prize by flying a human out of the atmosphere twice in 2 weeks. The prize had been created in the spirit of the great aviation challenges of the 1930s. Just as Charles Lindbergh flew across the Atlantic, spurred by a big cash prize before paying passengers existed, so too did the donors behind this prize hope to goose space commerce. To fund the prize's organizer, Peter Diamandis, called on the Ansaris, a wealthy Iranian family that had fled to the United States during the revolution. In the early 90s, Anousheh Ansari, then an employee of MCI, convinced her husband and brother-in-law to start a new company called Telecom Technologies, Inc., which provided software to manage the growth of digital networks. The timing was propitious, and their firm was acquired by a competitor at the peak of the internet bubble for more than $1.2 billion, making the family a fortune. After purchasing the insurance policy that guaranteed the X Prize in 2002, Anousheh became the first Iranian in space 2 years later when she paid a reported $20 million to spend 8 days on the International Space Station. Spaceship One was designed by Bert Rutan, a legendary engineer credited with creating some of the most innovative planes ever built. He was an eccentric, obsessed with ultra-strong, lightweight materials made of woven carbon fibers, a pioneer when many in the industry weren't ready to trust new composites over tried-and-true metals. Microsoft's Paul Allen, seeking a space investment of his own, had been won over by Rutan's effort to capture the perfect spaceflight prize and backed him with a $20 million investment. Unlike other space engineers, Rutan usually kept one foot in the atmosphere. Spaceship One is a space plane. This is a term of art for a vehicle that can reach space through rocket propulsion, but also has wings to generate lift, allowing it to fly in the atmosphere like an airplane. Picture the space shuttle landing on a runway at the end of its mission. That's a space plane. Some space engineers think it is inefficient to design a vehicle for both environments, which is how you wind up with space capsules that parachute back to Earth. Rutan, though, liked pilots. His vehicle was designed to be dropped from an airplane to save fuel. A custom-made mothership ferried the spacecraft almost 9 miles up before cutting it loose. Then the pilot would fire up the rocket engine and leave the atmosphere behind entirely. Branson already owned an airline, and he figured he understood the business of putting butts in seats for regular flights, so he created a joint venture with Rutan's Scaled Composites, calling it the Spaceship Company, TSC. TSC would build a larger, improved version of the vehicle for regular passenger flights. And to that end, he launched a new brand, Virgin Galactic. He envisioned daily operations where 7 space tourists would climb aboard the craft, travel to the edge of space, and enjoy a few minutes of weightlessness and incredible views before coming back down for a landing. Never one to miss an opportunity for the limelight, Branson began drumming up business for Virgin Galactic with gusto. He sold tickets to space for $250,000 a seat, which he bought for himself and his family, and then hawked to celebrities like Tom Hanks, Angelina Jolie, and Stephen Hawking. The first flights were expected to begin in 2007 from a new spaceport in New Mexico. Given the relative speed with which the Ansari X Prize had been won, less than 8 years of work between announcement and achievement, commercializing the design seemed like a fairly trivial engineering problem. It was 2004, and the space age that Americans had been promised for decades finally seemed within grasp. When Virgin Galactic was unveiled, Musk's SpaceX was still just a few years old, barely more than a group of enthusiasts. They were still planning a test flight for their first rocket, the Falcon 1. Virgin looked destined to be the first into the private spaceflight market, with a proven design, a sales plan in action, and a passionate backer making headlines. Is that why Bezos, whose space company predated them both, chose to unveil his company's plans and bold investment in 2005? Given the lack of warning and apparent lack of follow-up, the question is interesting. Bezos, unlike Musk or Branson, does not have the cocky salesman's personality, eager to win over the public and the press. He is, above all, an operator, a systems manager, and a strategist. Yet he is clearly world-beatingly ambitious, with a sense of timing that suggests he doesn't like to be forgotten. Yet, for all the attention they garnered, the splashy unveilings from both Branson and Bezos came to naught. Virgin Galactic's first flight kept being pushed further and further into the future. The same eccentricities that made Rutan the right person to hand-build an experimental spacecraft also brought him difficulty in designing one that could operate with consistent safety and be manufactured efficiently. The nature of a space plane like Rutan's is that it is neither fish nor fowl, perfect for neither atmospheric flight nor the vacuum of space, and it relied on a folding wing and an unusual propulsion system, both of which presented challenges. Its first spacecraft would not even perform a test flight until 2014, more than a decade after its prototype flew twice in 1 week. As of press time, none of its more than 700 paying customers have actually climbed into a spacecraft and ventured beyond the atmosphere. This long delay, combined with Branson's non-stop promotional promises, bolstered the reputation of the new space business as one dominated by dilettantes. Neither the cadres of engineers and scientists at NASA, who jealously guard their mission of space exploration, nor the premier American rocket builders at United Launch Alliance, ULA, a joint venture of venerable firms like Boeing and Lockheed Martin, were impressed. Sure, these new guys were good at putting rockets down on paper and drumming up hoopla in the media. But when were they going to actually fly something useful? Musk, at least, answered that question definitively, with the first flight of Falcon 9 in 2010. Its debut and 17 more successful flights in the next 5 years were sufficient to win over satellite operators and NASA, two groups that lived with budget pressure and prioritized SpaceX's dramatic cost savings. But there were still plenty of critics who thought Musk's team was cutting corners. Once you fly, you have to be reliable. Rockets are like banks in two ways. They're capital intensive, and they need confidence. So when the Falcon 9 exploded on June 28, 2015, 2 minutes and 18 seconds into its 19th flight, it didn't just signify a problem with that one contract or even for SpaceX alone. It was a threat to the entire concept of private space business that Musk and the other entrepreneurs were trying to reinvent, and to pry out of the hands of the military-industrial complex. SpaceX was in the middle of an effort to win the right to bid for launch contracts offered by the U.S. government, not as civil exploration missions, but for national security purposes, launching spy and communications satellites on behalf of the U.S. Air Force and the intelligence community. These jobs are tough to win for many reasons. They are top secret, and the technology involved is expensive and unique. Most of all, SpaceX's competitive advantage, being cheaper than anyone else, didn't matter as much, since cost had not been an object. United Launch Alliance, a company jointly owned by Boeing and Lockheed Martin, had won a full-fledged monopoly on national security launches in 2006, for one major reason. It was the only option. But it protected the monopoly because its primary rocket, the Atlas V, a descendant of the original American ICBMs, had a nearly perfect launch record. To break into the market, worth billions a year, Musk not only had to beat a monopoly at price, he also had to beat it at perfection. A few months before SpaceX's mission to the space station went so wrong, the two companies faced off before a panel of lawmakers in a wood-paneled Capitol Hill hearing room. While the Pentagon technically makes its own decisions about what rockets to buy, the billions it spends on space access have to be approved by the politicians in this room. It was a divided audience. Many lawmakers on the committee hailed from districts where ULA or its parent companies had facilities that supported jobs, investment, and tax revenue. They were not eager to see their gravy train displaced. And though some saw the growing cost of ULA rockets as a huge problem at a time of budget stress, others prioritized a guaranteed supply of reliable rockets. I love it when billionaires want to spend their own money to do cool things that help the country, but it's still a business, observed the committee chairman, an Alabama representative named Mike Rogers, whose district is home to both Boeing factories and NASA facilities. A timely new wrinkle was putting pressure on ULA. America's top rocket company relied on Russian-made rocket engines to keep its vehicles flying. After strongman Vladimir Putin in 2014 invaded Ukraine and annexed Crimea, defying the international community, even the most die-hard traditional defenders of ULA couldn't justify pumping hundreds of millions of dollars into Russia's defense industry. SpaceX's representative at the hearing wasn't about to let anyone forget about the Russian bear. The head of Russia's space enterprise, Dmitry Rogozin, had publicly stated that funds received from the United States for the Atlas rocket engine is free money that goes to the Russian missile program, SpaceX's Gwen Shotwell said in her opening statement. How do we justify buying more and funding the Russian military? If Musk empowered his team with a willingness to try anything, work differently, and do the impossible, Shotwell made sure that they had the resources, time, and funding to accomplish it. When SpaceX hit its lowest point, before the first Falcon 9 ever flew, it was Shotwell who had leveraged her personal credibility in the industry with a global sales tour that netted enough deposits to keep the lights on at the company. Once, at a meeting with the chief executive of a satellite company, one of SpaceX's clients, I wondered aloud how the relationship between the impulsive Musk and the steady Shotwell affected the company's approach. Oh, that's easy, he told me. Elon's the risk, Gwen's the reliability. For all her reputation as a problem solver, she was anything but staid. She had a sly sense of humor, wore stiletto heels at corporate events, and, at this hearing, sported a bold tartan blazer and the de rigueur American flag pin. She also had plenty of competitive spirit. Asked about the vast difference in price between ULA's rockets, which were estimated at $400 million per launch, versus the $100 million for a SpaceX rocket, Shotwell scoffed. "I don't know how to build a $400 million rocket," she said with a smile. Her opposite number, ULA Chief Executive Salvatore "Tori" Bruno, faced a harder sell. He, too, was a longtime aerospace leader, a Lockheed engineer who had spent much of his career building missile systems for the military. Bruno had been in this job for only a year, and he had SpaceX to thank for the privilege. When it became apparent that the upstarts were about to price ULA out of the market, ULA's parent companies swept out their old CEO. They brought in Bruno, with a mandate to cut costs, fix the company, and ultimately build a new rocket to compete with SpaceX. It was no easy task, but in Bruno, the company had found a unique leader. Beyond his experience in the industry, he had also written two books about the Knights Templar, the medieval military religious order that had inspired centuries of conspiracy theories. Bruno believed that the Templars, an international financial power in the 12th century, had management lessons to offer the modern business, though he assures me that he has no chainmail in his office. But he was willing to take a project on faith, and showed no small part of discipline. Weeks later, he would force out a dozen ULA executives as part of his house cleaning. Before Congress, however, he was just buying time. The economics of his rockets, which were simply more expensive than those made by SpaceX, meant that he needed a new rocket that was just as effective but cheaper. That meant designing a new rocket engine. And he had a solution in mind. "I would like to say a couple of words about our path to an American rocket engine," Bruno began. "We entered into a strategic partnership with Blue Origin late last year, a company founded by Amazon founder Jeff Bezos." Blue Origin had gone back underground after its big land purchase a decade before, though it was hiring engineers and working on closely held projects. "Good people would disappear for years, and you'd have no idea what they were working on," one Virgin Galactic executive told me of the Blue Origin operation. It was a rarity in the close-knit aerospace industry, where ostensibly rivals frequently wind up as partners, and everyone knows one another's business. In 2011, Bezos's space company reemerged. Blue had a short-lived deal with NASA to begin development of its first full-scale rocket engine and launch vehicle, though it still shared little about its work with the public. Now it was acting as the savior for SpaceX's biggest competitor. Instead of investing its own money to develop a new engine, ULA could rely on Bezos's wealth to develop one. And Bezos now had access to the know-how and experience at the most successful American launch company. If battle lines had been drawn before, they were now. SpaceX had partnered with NASA to make an entrance to the space industry. Blue Origin was now linking up with SpaceX's biggest rival to do the same. To underscore Bezos's return to the stage, a month after the hearing, Blue Origin revealed its first launch of a space vehicle at the scrubby Van Horn Ranch. The rocket in question was small, just 50 feet tall, and looked something like a child's toy, with its rounded edges and stubby silhouette. It was called the New Shepard, after Alan Shepard, the first American to reach space. In an unmanned test, the New Shepard flew 58 miles up to the very edge of space. Now Bezos had skin in the game. He was a member of the most exclusive club in the world. Billionaires with their own rockets. The weeks after Musk's ruined birthday were hectic. His team of engineers launched an internal investigation to determine what exactly had gone wrong with the exploding CRS-7 rocket. Working 24/7 and poring over reams of data from more than 3,000 sensors on the vehicle. The Federal Aviation Administration, which supervises commercial rocket launches, had its own investigation underway. Meanwhile, SpaceX's critics were now armed with dramatic evidence to support their allegations of shoddy work and the company's efforts to convince Air Force officials of its vehicle's reliability had clearly been set back. NASA officials, though publicly supportive of Musk's team, wanted answers and guarantees that this wouldn't happen again. While he had once threatened to charge extra for every additional requirement imposed by the government space agency, he was now reorganizing his engineering team to adopt the kind of structured, reviews-based process that NASA preferred. He had to please NASA, his biggest client, at a time when SpaceX was being paid billions of dollars to fly cargo to the space station and design a spacecraft to take astronauts there within the next 2 years. When he spoke to reporters in July to share the preliminary results of the investigation, it sounded as if the stress had taken its toll on SpaceX's chief designer. Exhausted and a bit glum, Musk seemed as though he wanted to discuss anything other than the loss of his rocket less than a month before. He lamented the fact that the Dragon space capsule carrying the NASA supplies hadn't been equipped with the emergency escape rockets that his engineers were developing for the human-crewed variant. It would have been able to escape the mid-flight explosion and presumably have saved the cargo. The tale Musk told of the rocket's failure was emblematic of how the smallest details matter when dealing with the extreme forces a rocket experiences during flight. What went wrong was this. As the 9 engines power the rocket into orbit, the vehicle experiences massive forces, the equivalent of more than 3 times normal gravity, from pushing through the atmosphere so quickly. Inside the rocket, bottles that store helium, used to pressurize the engine, are held in place by steel struts. Under those heavy forces, a strut snapped. The helium bottle broke loose inside a rocket going more than 4,300 miles an hour, ricocheting around inside a tank full of liquid oxygen. The helium now pouring from the rogue tank was inert, but it expanded to overpressurize the oxygen vessel, which burst. Liquid oxygen is not inert, and it ignited, exploding the rocket. The whole process, from snapped strut to total destruction, took just 0.893 seconds, according to Musk. But even as he described an event that clearly pained him, the technical explanation and the forensic engineering work that went into determining it had Musk feeling more engaged. "It's a really, really odd failure mode," he observed in his jargony way. Musk was precise about whose fault the rocket loss was, too. The unnamed supplier that had provided those steel struts. That supplier would not be used again. Homegrown solutions would be found. 7 years ago, when we had our first failure, we were about 400 people. Now we are about 4,000 people, he said. I think to some degree the company as a whole maybe became complacent. A month after the mishap, Musk promised a return to flight no later than September. But by the end of October, it wasn't clear when the next SpaceX flight would lift off. The scuttlebutt was that the FAA wasn't signing off on SpaceX's reasoning for the rocket loss. The strut was a red herring, so these theories went. And the real problem would be found in the advanced materials used to build the helium tank itself. SpaceX used a technique to build tanks out of carbon fiber that most space engineers thought was too risky. Keeping carbon fiber, an organic material, around liquid oxygen was asking for an ugly chemical reaction. It was the most trying time in the company's history. No one outside SpaceX was sure how much money they were losing as they missed upcoming dates for flights. Musk estimated hundreds of millions of dollars. And insiders were suddenly second-guessing themselves. And though they didn't know it, SpaceX was about to be beaten to the punch by Blue Origin. If you needed a signal that Jeff Bezos was excited about the news that he wanted to reveal, the medium was the message. The secretive Amazon tycoon joined the social media platform Twitter in November 2015 to reveal the biggest step forward in what had been Blue Origin's so far unremarkable history as a rocket company. The rarest of beasts, a used rocket, controlled landing not easy, but done right can look easy. The online mogul tweeted to his rapidly growing entourage of followers, sharing a link to a video posted on Blue Origin's website. The company